You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Around 100 sick or injured civilians have been permitted to leave the eastern Ghouta region of Syria yesterday. These evacuees are the first people to leave the zone since the short-lived ceasefire led by Syria's ally Russia and decided last month. The ceasefire is one of many that have been agreed on since the beginning of the fight in this region in 2012. The 400,000 residents of the zone have been trapped in there for years, and the recent escalation of violence has meant severe shortage of food and medicine. I spoke with Otago University Professor William Harris and started by asking him to explain why this region is so instrumental in the wider conflict and how did the situation get this bad.
Eastern Ghouta is an area of the suburbs of Damascus, quite close to the centre, to the northeast. And it's been held by the rebels since 2012. It's been quite a significant area of land. And to some degree, they've had food supplies from that land itself, as well as stuff that's been smuggled in. So any siege has only been imperfect. And for the regime, this is the last remaining rebel stronghold on the edge of the capital itself. And to take it would give Bashar al-Assad considerable military relief in his centre of power, as well as obviously a prestige boost.
May 2017 was quite an important date. There was a ceasefire deal and it wasn't really respected, and also it coincides with the instauration of a de-escalation zone. So yeah. Maybe try to do a little catch up on what's been going on ever since.
We can start with 2016, because in 2016 there was a regime and Hezbollah offensive against the eastern Ghouta, and they managed to clip off a reasonable amount of its territory, and that was facilitated by an important factor, which is infighting between the rebel groups or among the rebel groups within that area. There's a large group by the name of Jaish al-Islam, the Army of Islam, which is been backed by Saudi Arabia, and it competes both with the a smallish group of al-Nusra jihadists and another rebel group called Falak al-Rahman, which was part of the old Free Syrian Army and is less Islamist, I suppose you could say, than the others. And these especially Jaish al-Islam and Falak al-Rahman fought each other at the same time as the regime was doing this offensive. And that was very detrimental for that area and its long-term holding capacity. And then in 2017, as you say, May 2017, there was this arrangement patronized by Turkey, Russia and Iran that have been together in a rather difficult alignment since then, and they dreamed up these de-escalation zones in western Syria by which there were ceasefires between the rebel groups and different areas and pockets on the one hand and the regime on the other hand. But of course that's collapsed in the eastern Ghouta, because the regime has been determined and is backed by the Russians to clear that area away. And one wonders what sort of trade-offs have gone on here with regard to the rest of western Syria, because of course Turkey has been very active in the north and the Russians have stood back from that. And Turkey has said actually very little about what's been going on in the eastern Ghouta. So one wonders if there isn't some sort of trade-off by which the Turks buttress the area that they patronize in the far north at the expense of letting go of this area near Damascus.
And so what's going on at the moment? What's been going on in this area since 2018?
Well, if we're talking about the eastern Ghouta, yes. Of course there's been a major regime offensive backed by Russia since mid-February, and as you know, with about 1,200 civilians killed by quite heavy aerial and surface bombardment. And the ceasefire attempts, including a United Nations attempt, an actual resolution from the Security Council, have counted for nothing. The West has stood back from all this, despite its verbal engagement. In real terms, it stood back. And it's hard really to judge who is the more cynical in this, whether it's the Russians, who had no intention of honouring the ceasefire and dreamed up a humanitarian corridor which couldn't possibly work, and they knew it couldn't possibly work. Whether it's them who are the most cynical, or the Western powers that quite plainly never intended to put any enforcement behind their participation in the Security Council resolution.
So it's all show and no action, really. It's just taking positions.
From the Western powers, absolutely. Mm. I mean, no, nothing. I mean, there has been some noise from the United States and France about use of chemical weaponry, meaning chlorine gas, by the regime side in this affair, which obviously has quite a long history. And there have been threats from the U.S. to strike if there's a continuation of use of chemicals by the regime. The regime simply, despite the fact the regime was hit last year, of course, for using sarin gas further north in western Syria, despite that, they don't really take the United States seriously and feel that they have cover from the Russians. And the Russians have also been making noises that they may react to any Western military intervention.
What is the humanitarian situation over there?
Oh, it's really hard to judge that from here, but as far as we can tell, it's absolutely awful. And those people obviously are short of food, and the 400,000 or so people within what's left of that enclave, which has now been split into three bits. And of course, the military offensive goes on, and as medical facilities have been targeted through this, the capacity to look after wounded people is limited. So we do know all that, but beyond that, of course, we're not there, and it's hard to have a serious, detailed reading of the situation. But all we know is that it's really bad.
The conflict in Syria has been going on since 2011, and throughout these past 7 years, it has heavily complexified. What was a civilian uprising heavily repressed by the regime turned into a fight between national and international entities, with civilians trapped in the middle and often used as instruments of propaganda on either sides. Staying well informed on the matter has become increasingly difficult, as both the regime and the rebels use existing or new network to push their agenda forward. I asked Professor Harris how he keeps informed and how journalists can navigate the grey waters and portray the conflict in as much of a truthful light as possible.
I follow, obviously, internet sources that a lot of other people follow. There's a pretty good one that your listeners might be interested in, which is Syria Live Map. If you feed that into the internet, you get quite a reasonable running commentary, which seems not to be too oriented to this or that side, and reports what's happened to each of them against a map background. And that looks to be a fairly decent source. Also, I use the Arabic, the mainline Arabic press, a newspaper called Al Hayat, and another one called Shart Al Awsat. Al Hayat is also, I think, a fairly reasonable source. It has Saudi backing, but it also wants to present itself as an international Arabic newspaper of record, so it feels it has a reputation to uphold. So it's not too bad as well.
I also wanted to talk maybe a little bit about the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights and how I feel like it's still held as like the main source of information for a lot of Western media, and whether it really should be.
My feeling about that is that they're actually reasonably conservative in a lot of their numbers. Several years ago, the UN was giving estimates of casualties and that sort of thing. The UN High Commission, the UN Commission for Human Rights, and other UN bodies. And the Syrian Observatory was giving figures that were lower for casualties at that stage, which is three or more years ago, than the UN. So I think it gives you a reasonable picture that they do, those people who operate in Britain. And for a long time, I think it's been, to a large degree, a one-man operation. They say that they match, that they try to get corroboration of casualties. They try to put forward numbers that represent casualties that they can actually document in one way or another. I mean, I think this is the case with every, virtually every conflict like this, that there's a difficulty in getting hold of well-developed numbers as to casualties and that sort of thing. I think the Syrian Observatory does tries its really best to do a decent job, and as you know, it is used by a lot of Western sources. I think the general trend it gives, the general level of numbers it's giving, are probably reflective of reality.
Do you think that the media, well, at least the Western one, I guess, is kind of still stuck in a very Manichaean vision of the conflict, still kind of like good guys, bad guys, you know, the regime, bad guys, the rebels, good guys, and kind of like overlooking the complexity of the entire conflict?
Well, I mean, there's all sorts of grey zones amongst the various parties, and you've got the jihadists, and you've got the foreign interventions of various descriptions. And everybody's been shelling and bombing, of course. And I don't think you can entirely remove a moral plane from this. And here I can only give my perspective. My perspective is that the regime is the origin of this mess. The way the regime behaved in the years before the breakdown, the way the regime behaved in the trend from a protest, from street protests and a street uprising towards full militarization. The regime has been the major engine of causing casualties and that sort of thing. And we have some really horrific stuff against this regime in terms of the prison systems it's been running, in terms of the thousands of people that have been killed in prisons. The use of poison gas, the bombing of civilian medical facilities, that sort of thing, the bombing of queues at bakeries some years ago. It just goes on and on. And there's no question that the major breaker of human rights, the major criminality, is from the regime, and I know that's obviously a solid view in the West. Not one with much effect on what goes on there, of course. In addition to that, we have the backers of the regime that have kept this show going. And here we're obviously talking about Iran and Russia.
Yeah.
And also, none of those parties for a long time had too much serious interest in the degradation of ISIS, which for them was quite convenient for a considerable period, because ISIS operated more against rebels than against the regime.
Yeah.
And ISIS was a good excuse for bombing rebels in general when the Russian bombing campaign got going. So I think there's a pretty good argument that there is a side to this that is more responsible than other sides, and that's the regime side.
Yeah, that being said, obviously, well, we also ought to report on there are civilian casualties with the rebels.
There's plenty of stuff that's caused by other people. I mean, of course there is, and that's the case with all such conflicts.
Yeah.
It's multi-sided, it's multifaceted. But if you look at the whatever numbers come out, it's the regime responsibility that hits you as number one. And then others come in as number two, three, four, and whatever. And, of course, there's been all sorts of absolutely atrocious stuff that's been done by others in this conflict. But I don't think that takes the regime off the hook.
Since February 2018, the various rebel groups in Eastern Ghouta have lost a lot of ground, and many localities have been taken back by the loyalist forces of the Syrian regime. As more and more areas fall back into the regime's hands, the idea of the government defeating rebel factions altogether is becoming more likely. What will become of Syria when it happens? Professor Harris holds a pretty strong view on what has to happen next.
We're going to have the Russians and the regime come to us down the track if, in military terms, they get what they want, in terms of the reconstruction of Syria. And there's a big question for the West here as to the, if we regard the regime as the primary source of this entire mess, how can we take part in any reconstruction of Syria when there is essentially an unchanged regime?
But that's been a question that the West has been dealing with for quite a while now, probably ever since, you know, 2013 or something like that. And there's
I mean, we're sold a line from the regime, Russian, the Iranian side, that only the Syrian people have the right to determine what happens to Syria, etc., etc. I don't accept that. Because of the international repercussions of this conflict, the flow of refugees, the effect on all sorts of other people right across the planet, we all have a right to a say in what happens to Syria. They have a right to elect what they like and that sort of thing, but we have a right not to approve of that, and we certainly have a right not to have our taxpayers' dollars go into reconstructing an unreconstructed regime.
But how do we get to the point where we, well, when I say we, I guess the West, you know, doesn't back up the regime and the reconstruction? Like, how do we get out of this conflict without keeping al-Assad in power, at least for a little bit? Because he's so strong at the moment, I don't see how that's going to happen.
Of course he's strong principally because of his backers, whom he plays between, and he's quite good at that. The Russians, I imagine, will watch him very closely. I mean, our choice essentially is, yes, maybe he's going to stay there. He is a war criminal. There's absolutely no question about that. Mm. It is our right not to spend money on supporting a show in which he continues to be the main mover. I know that may be tough for the population. And here, I think there's a differentiation between humanitarian aid and actual reconstruction of the country.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly have my own perspective as that we must not be involved in reconstructing something that's under an unreconstructed regime. That's our absolute bottom line. And we tell the Russians and the Iranians that there will be nothing from us, and we will do our best to frustrate things that do not produce a decent regime in that country.
Because if we support the reconstruction, it would be like giving our support to the regime.
That's right. I mean, you can generate an argument that anybody who knowingly, with that unchanged regime in place, is pumping money into Syria, part of that money, of course, given the mafia-style behavior of that regime, part of that money will end up in the Caribbean and other such places. You've got to accept that. Maybe 20 or 30% of it will be siphoned off. And we just can't deal with a show like that. And we've got to make it very plain, if necessary through use of things like vetoes at the Security Council,
mm-hmm.
That we don't approve of exercises that don't answer our concerns.
Yeah, pretty strong opinion on the matter.
Professor Wilson, I think just listening to that, we should be wary that that is a strong advocate for intervention, which we've learned over history. Western intervention isn't always, it's not a great move.
The best way to help the people.
Mm. Often Western intervention is actually what causes the issue in the first place.
Yeah, which is kind of what happened in the Syria in the first place, so probably not the best outcome possible.
Perhaps we could look more into other voices on that issue.
Yes.
The Wire. That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.